Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
I'm hopeful. Kind of the conversation that I'm hearing around the building is I think we're going to get there.
State senators consider the House-passed Alaska LNG tax cut bill. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 16th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage tests out a new crisis response team to help those in need.
If we don't provide positive help, we are going to be encountering them through police and fire.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Consider a gift of stock to Alaska Public Media. You may avoid paying capital gains tax and receive a deduction. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/stock or contact your financial advisor.
State senators are closely examining a House-passed bill offering tax cuts for a North Slope natural gas pipeline as they near Friday's deadline to end a special session on the issue. Most of their concerns center on one theme: what's at risk for Alaskans if things don't go according to plan? At a hearing this morning, senators pressed executives with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and pipeline developer Glenfarne on what would happen if the project falls apart. Glenfarne Alaska LNG President Adam Prestige told lawmakers it was hard to imagine any scenario in which the state would be on the hook. Prestige says the way the project is structured, along with price controls included in the bill lawmakers are considering, mean only Glenfarne and investors who buy equity in the project would bear the risk of cost overruns or project failure.
If Glenfarne were to determine that the project had failed, or if Glenfarne were to decide to abandon the project, we wouldn't have any way to seek any recourse or any reimbursement for what we have done.
Another key question on senators' minds is just how big a tax cut is necessary to allow the project to move forward. Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman says he's convinced there needs to be some tax relief to make the project viable. But he says so far he hasn't seen anything from Glenfarne showing how big that tax break needs to be.
There needs to be some concession or a change given to help the project get economically more viable. Okay, so the challenge we have is measuring that. For what we put on the table, what's the benefit?
Prestige says he'd come back with answers soon, but the clock is ticking. The 30-day special session has to end by Friday. Senator Rob Myers, a Fairbanks Republican in the Minority Caucus, says he'd like to see a small change to the bill that passed the House 34-5 on Friday, but he says he expects the Senate will pass something before the special session ends.
I'm hopeful. Kind of the conversation that I'm hearing around the building is I think we're going to get there. We'll see what it looks like.
Governor Mike Dunleavy said last month that if lawmakers did not pass an acceptable bill during this special session, he'd call them right back for another. Senator Lisa Murkowski is among several members of Congress trying to prevent the National Science Foundation from dismantling portions of an instrument system that monitors the nation's oceans. The Alaska Beacon reports the National Science Foundation plans to pull out much of the instrumentation in the Ocean Observatory's initiative system, which began operating in 2016 and was intended to last for 3 decades. Under the Trump administration, the National Science Foundation plans in the coming year to remove instruments from the waters off Alaska, as well as Washington State, Oregon, North Carolina, and Greenland. In a letter Monday to the National Science Foundation's acting director, Murkowski and 9 other senators urged the agency to reverse the decision. The letter says the instruments are especially important this year because of the powerful El Nino system that is developing in the Pacific Ocean and is poised to disrupt widespread weather patterns. The system is also of particular importance to Alaska's multi-billion-dollar fishing industry, which has objected to the removal. A spokesperson for the National Science Foundation defended the changes as a de-scoping rather than a dismantling of the system. A lot of police and emergency service work is actually responding to people with mental health and substance use problems. But until recently, there weren't great options in Anchorage for people in crisis. Now, relatively new crisis response programs embedded in the city police and fire departments are helping those in need. And as Alaska Public Media's Hannah Flora reports, that frees up responders to focus on crime and medical emergencies.
Jennifer Pierce is riding shotgun. A paramedic is at the wheel.
How are you doing today?
When she gets a call.
Okay. Can we try to take some slow, deep breaths together on the phone?
Pierce is with the Anchorage Fire Department. She heads a team that responds to people having mental health or substance use crises.
We'll be there in about 5-10 minutes. Okay.
Pierce used to be a beat cop. Now she works in mental health. She says the crisis response team is a big shift from her job a few years ago.
I felt like I was really ill-equipped to talk to someone who is suicidal, other than I can take you to the hospital. but is that really what someone needed in the moment?
Pierce works with the fire department's mobile crisis team. It's part of a multi-agency approach to public safety that pairs therapists and social workers with emergency responders. In the past, when the police or fire departments got emergency calls, there really wasn't a great option for people having a tough time with mental health or substance use challenges. It was basically jail or the emergency room. Now, crisis response teams are getting those people help, roughly 500 unique individuals a month, according to city data. Assistant Fire Chief Ben Lewis oversees the mobile crisis team. He says call volume for the Anchorage Fire Department has increased over 50% in the past decade, and a lot of those are mental health and substance use calls.
Our mobile crisis team has responded to 3,000 calls for service year to date. Our busiest ambulance in the city, just as a comparison, runs about 4,500 in a year. So the demand for services is very, very high for the mobile crisis team.
Thea Agnew-Benben is with the mayor's office. She says the crisis response is the same thing you'd expect if you broke your arm, but for mental health. You call someone, they show up, and they help fix your problem.
What if there wasn't a way to get your broken arm dealt with very easily? We'd all be walking around with, like, our arms at weird angles. And then we'd all be wondering, like, what's wrong with everyone's arms?
Agnew-Benben says the teams are reconnecting people with their support systems, de-escalating situations, and helping people maintain or regain their stability. That makes it possible for patrol officers and EMS crews to respond to emergencies that are more in their wheelhouse. And it frees up emergency rooms and hospital beds, too, since the crisis response teams are usually helping people where they are. Agnew-Benben says data shows about 80% of the time the situation is resolved just by talking on the phone or with a quick visit from a crisis response team. It seems small, she says, but without that, unchecked mental health and addiction problems can escalate.
If we don't provide positive help, we are going to be encountering them through police and fire.
Agnew-Benben says substance use and mental health challenges overlap with all sorts of other issues, like health problems and chronic homelessness. At a recent press conference, Anchorage Police Chief Sean Case said studies by the department show it plays a huge role in police shootings.
Behavioral health is impacting some of these incidents. And when I say the majority of them, I'm talking like 90% of them. It's a very high percentage.
He's excited, he said, that the crisis response programs make it possible to get people help before situations require a traditional police response. But Agnew-Benben says when people need more than a call or a quick visit, there aren't a lot of treatment options. There are some residential and walk-in programs in the city, but she says not enough. That'll change this fall when two places open that are meant to rapidly stabilize people in mental health or substance use crises. She says once those crisis stabilization centers are open, response teams will have a place to take people that can actually meet their needs.
I'm hoping we're going to see a lot of people who maybe for years haven't been able to engage with care and get back to a life that is healthier and safer for them, where they're more connected to their family, where they can maintain their housing and not be in crisis all the time.
Agnew-Benben says she expects South Central Foundation Center to open by this fall and Providence's Stabilization Center to open by the end of the year. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Flohr.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau artist launches a new magazine for Indigenous art and stories.
Like it kind of came together through everyone just being willing to be vulnerable or share the things that they wanted to share, the things that they care about.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Consider a gift of stock to Alaska Public Media. You may avoid paying capital gains tax and receive a deduction. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/stock or contact your financial advisor.
An Oregon man died near Ketchikan after getting lost on a hike and apparently falling off a cliff, according to Alaska State Troopers. Searchers found the man, believed to be 49-year-old Portland resident Heath Didier, early Monday after he had gotten lost near the Deer Mountain Trail on Sunday. Troopers say Didier sent an alert Sunday night using a locator beacon with messaging capabilities saying he was lost, cold, and wet, and did not have water, food, or proper clothing. Troopers lost contact with Didier, and a subsequent search by the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad was unsuccessful. Volunteers in a helicopter resumed searching Monday morning and found a man believed to be Didier dead and partially submerged in water at the bottom of a cliff. A trooper spokesperson told the Anchorage Daily News that Didier appeared to have fallen off the cliff, which was about 400 yards from the intersection of two trails. Jerry Kiefer with the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad urged hikers to be cautious about going off trails and to be prepared to be outside overnight.
The trip took longer than he anticipated. He got off of the trail and it got dark. And at that point, activate your beacon and don't go anywhere. Just sit down and wait. We'll come up. We'll send a team up to help you out. But walking around it in that country at night is not a good idea.
It is not clear whether Didier was visiting Ketchikan or in town on a longer-term basis. A brown bear attacked a man biking the Dome Trail in Anchorage on Saturday, according to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Anchorage area biologist Corey Stantorf says the victim was riding his bike down the trail when he encountered a bear walking toward him.
He was able to stop before he got right to the bear, and he yelled at the bear, made himself look big, and then the bear charged. He was able to get his bike in front of him. The bear hit the bike once, knocked it down, then knocked the victim down.
He says the bear scratched and bit the man above the waist. The injuries are serious, Stantorf says, but not life-threatening. The attack was within a mile of the Stuckagin Heights trailhead for the Dome. Stantorf says the victim self-rescued to the trailhead and received care at an Anchorage area hospital. He says the victim had bear spray but was not able to deploy it. He says the man did not have a dog, which can sometimes prompt attacks. Stantorf says the bear was likely startled by the man, sending the animal into fight-or-flight mode.
A lot of times we see brown bears go into that fight mode. They have no idea what just came on them. They're a little bit startled. They see a perceived threat. They neutralize it, and then they get out of the area, which is exactly what this specific bear did.
He says the department will not try to find the bear because the animal was exhibiting normal bear behavior. The Dome Trail is more than 7 miles out and back and takes up to 6 hours to complete on foot, according to All Trails, an outdoor recreation website. This is the second aggressive bear encounter on the Dome Trail in less than a year. A brown bear mauled and seriously injured a woman hiking the same trail last July. There are several salmon streams near the trail, which Stantorf says are bear magnets.
Any wildlife encounter in general is a super unfortunate event, and it is a risk that we take as we recreate in backcountry.
You can find best practices for bear safety from Alaska's Department of Fish and Game on their website, adfg.alaska.gov. If you encounter an aggressive animal, contact wildlife troopers or your local fish and game office. An Eagle River woman says she's grateful to be alive after a black bear attacked her dog near Skelak Lake earlier this month. She had been foraging in a popular outdoor Kenai Peninsula recreation area. KDLL's Ashlyn O'Hara reports.
Sunday, June 7th, was a great day for mushroom hunting near Cooper Landing. At least, that's what Lori Price thought. She's a self-described avid outdoors woman who's lived in Alaska for 2 decades. And until then, she had never had a violent encounter with a bear. But that all changed quickly. Price says she was foraging near the upper Skelak Lake campground when she heard her 3-year-old German short-haired pointer, Chaos, make what she describes as a screeching yip noise. At first, she says she was in disbelief.
It dawned on me when I started hearing those sounds after that it was like, holy crap, like this is really happening. My dog is getting mauled by a bear and that bear is super close.
Price says she ran through tall Devil's Club and dense alder toward Chaos, stopping when she came face to face with a black bear. She pulled her 9mm Glock pistol and fired at the bear, which she said dropped, quote, like a sack of potatoes. She shot and hit it again when it got back up. She says she isn't sure whether a third shot actually hit the bear. Price, Chaos, and her chocolate lab Willis, who was unharmed in the incident, ran back to the road where she flagged down a car. The driver, an off-duty Homer police officer, gave Chaos first aid while Price fought bad reception to call 911. After talking with an emergency dispatcher, first responders, and wildlife officers, Price got permission to get Chaos to a vet. The Kenai Animal Hospital is about 30 miles from the west end of Skelak Lake Road. Price says an on-call emergency veterinarian was waiting for her and Chaos with a gurney when they got to Kenai. Price says Chaos was diagnosed with a broken tail and multiple wounds to his back.
When I walked around before we loaded him, my heart sunk and broke. I had no idea that he had been bit and chomped so many times by that black bear.
Pictures taken by Price of Chaos at the vet show multiple large punctures on his shaved back and a crisscross of lacerations and gashes. He faced a setback Sunday evening, according to a post Price shared on social media. A Soldotna vet determined Chaos is also suffering from a broken vertebrae and dead muscle tissue. The Friday following the attack, an Alaska State Trooper spokesman said troopers tried to track the bear, but did not find one, dead or alive. Price says she's received a lot of criticism since sharing her story on social media, from the type of gun she was carrying to using e-collars for her dogs instead of leashes. But she says she doesn't have any regrets.
For all the haters, I did what I needed to do, and I would do it again for going out there for my, not putting my dog in that situation. I would never want that. But I would go out and enjoy the outdoors.
In general, bear attacks are rare, but they do happen. State data from 2019 found around 70 people were hospitalized or died after bear attacks between 2000 and 2017. That's an average of around 4 attacks per year. The largest proportion occurred in Alaska's Gulf Coast region, which includes the Kenai Peninsula and Kodiak. Last year, a bear mauled a Kenai woman jogging near her home, and two hikers in Seward were injured after being attacked by a brown bear on the Exit Glacier Trail in Kenai Fjords National Park. The Skelak Lake area, which sits in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, has also seen bear attacks in recent years. Two kayakers paddled 6 miles to safety in 2021 after being mauled by a bear on the shore of Skelak Lake, near where Price was foraging last weekend. And a 72-year-old man was attacked while hiking the Hidden Creek Trail, which ends at Skelak Lake, in 2023. Price says the attack has not curbed her love of foraging. After losing her voice from all the screaming, she says the scratchy cadence is proof of healing. She's thinking about getting a bigger gun, but she won't be returning to that particular area anytime soon.
I'm just really grateful the way it turned out, and I hope that the recovery of my dog is going to be okay.
To stay safe during bear season, biologists recommend stowing bear attractants, like fish waste and food, in a bear-proof container. Hikers should make noise or talk while on a trail and carry bear bells and bear spray. Look for signs of a bear in the area, like tracks or scat, and try to avoid surprising bears when possible. If you encounter a bear that does not notice you, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recommends backing away quietly. And if you encounter a bear that does notice you, wave your arms in the air and speak to it in a loud voice. If a bear approaches you, stay still. If a bear attacks, lay on your stomach and play dead, covering your head and neck with your hands. Reporting in Soldotna, I'm Ashlyn O'Hara.
GCI internet and mobile service has been fully restored across the Aleutians, ending an outage that began 3 weeks ago. GCI's undersea fiber cable was damaged on May 27th, disrupting phone and internet service in communities including Accutan, False Pass, King Cove, Perryville, Sandpoint, and Unalaska. GCI had expected repairs to be finished last week, but weather pushed back the work. Many Aleutian residents rely on GCI for cell phone service, and it operates the only fiber optic network in the region. GCI spokesperson Josh Edge says technical teams will keep monitoring the network to make sure service is operating normally. He says the company does not have details on what caused the damage. Residents of Anaktuvik Pass can now use four-wheelers to subsistence hunt in gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. The change was announced by the U.S. Interior Secretary during a visit last month. As the Alaska Desk's Alyona Nyden reports, residents of the North Slope Village have been fighting for this decision for decades.
Mark John Morey has been hunting caribou around Anaktuvik Pass since he was a child. But in the summer and fall, most of the land around the village has been off-limits to hunters like him. That's because residents were not allowed to use four-wheelers in the majority of the gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. And that's the only way to access the roadless preserve surrounding the village. But last month, the U.S. Department of the Interior announced it would restore off-road vehicle access to the park. Maury says he's excited.
This is life-changing. I only wish my grandparents were here. Now that we're able to access the lens, we can relearn what our ancestors taught us about certain areas that always have caribou year-round.
The Trump administration has been working to expand access to hunters on off-road vehicles in protected federal lands across the country. However, a National Park Service spokesman for the Alaska region said this action is specific to subsistence hunting in the Gates and does not apply to sports hunters. And it comes after decades of back and forth on the issue. Before Anaktuvik Pass became a permanent settlement about 80 years ago, the Nunimut people were semi-nomadic and moved throughout the Brooks Range. Maury says they were searching for their main food source, caribou.
We heard many stories from our elders about hunting grounds that we weren't able to access, which they remember before we even formed the community of Anaktuvik Pass.
The federal government established the gates of the Arctic around Anaktuvik Pass when it passed the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. And residents were still given the right to subsistence hunt using snow machines and motorboats, among other traditional transportation methods. But the rule didn't mention ATVs. And 40 years ago, the new park guidance interpreted the law to ban hunts on ATVs because they were not used traditionally. Lillian Stone is the city mayor of Anaktuvik Pass. She says the ban created invisible boundaries for residents relying on hunting for survival.
It was like we were prisoners in our own land for 40 years, where before that it was we could hunt anywhere, we could travel anywhere.
Local native corporations exchanged lands with the Park Service in the late 90s, which made additional areas within the park available for subsistence ATV hunts. Still, residents could only access about 1% of the gates of the Arctic. Stone says residents and local leaders have been advocating for ATV access to the park for subsistence for decades, but with no progress.
We felt like it wasn't getting anywhere and we weren't getting the answers that were needed.
Last year, local leadership traveled to Washington, D.C. and asked the Interior Department to restore ATV access to the park. This May, the department announced the decision to do that. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum wrote in a social media post that, quote, "No one knows or cares for this land more than the people who live here," end quote. A department spokeswoman said in an email the old ban was inconsistent with supporting subsistence. She said the Park Service will consult local communities within 6 months to establish the new rule. Kristen Mori is an Anaktuvik Pass hunter and a mother of two. She says the announcement means a lot for her and her children.
I have no words of what of what just happened because it just makes me really emotional, and I'm excited to be out there and to no longer have to worry about when we have to stop, because I'm out there year-round as well.
The Park Service said local hunters should contact the Gates of the Arctic for current information on using ATVs while the regulatory process is underway. In Anchorage, I am Alona Knighton.
A Juno artist created a magazine for Indigenous writers and creators to share their art and perspectives without having to reduce or simplify them to fit into the bounds of traditional media run by non-Native people. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry reports.
Tlingit artist Chloe Cavanaugh released the first issue of the Black and White Raven Company magazine earlier this month. She said she was frustrated seeing Alaska media outlets cover stories about Indigenous people without care and follow-through. She says she wanted a platform for Indigenous artists and writers to have control of their own stories.
You know, I thought that, well, if this is something that I'm seeing and this is something that I'm frustrated by, then I should do something about it.
In the 43-page debut issue of the magazine, one essay by Chadistine Connor-Meyer delves further into what it means for non-Native media to extract Alaska Native stories. It opens with, quote, "Outside people are telling inside stories," unquote. The issue also features a short story by renowned Juno author San Kashlat Ernestine Hayes about memories of her grandmother. Work by Tlingit artists Rachel Martin and Guna Jensen and others fill the space between stories, essays, and a poem. Kavanaugh says the contributors made her role as a first-time magazine editor easier.
People made it really easy with what they shared, and yeah, like it kind of came together through everyone just being willing to be vulnerable or share the things that they wanted to share, the things that they care about.
Contributors donated their work for the debut issue, Kavanaugh says. She hopes to pay creators in the future. The plan now is to put out one or two issues a year. In future ones, Kavanaugh wants to see people dig into current matters that affect tribal citizens in Juneau.
I think it would be really cool to be able to include more things about things that are like shifting in our community, of like getting Gold Belt to talk about the dock that's being built and how that impacts our community. See Alaska to talk more in depth about the things that they're invested in. And like, sometimes we like skim the surface, but I want this to be a space to be able to dive deeper.
And while Kavanaugh is the creator and editor of the magazine, she wants it to be filled with perspectives other than her own.
You know, these voices in this magazine are representative of our community. And, you know, every community has people who think differently and have different ideas, lived experiences. And I wanted that to be reflected in the magazine.
The Black and White Raven Company magazine isn't online yet, just print. And the first run of 100 copies sold out a couple hours into the launch. Kavanaugh ordered hundreds more, and now it's restocked. She's already seeking sponsors for the second issue. The magazines are available in downtown Juneau for $25 at Alaska Robotics and Ewing Dry Goods. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cormery.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Yvonne Cormery in Juneau, Hannah Floor, Ava White, and Aliona Niden in Anchorage, Sydney Dauphiné in Ketchikan, Ashlyn O'Hara in Soldotna, and Sophia Stewart Rossi in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.